From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, we'll hear from a group that gathers at the same spot every year to remember those who have died homeless on San Francisco's streets.
Sleeping on the cold, on concrete. You know, it got pretty brutal.
Then we'll talk with San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell, who's examining how effectively the city is tracking homelessness.
You know, no neighborhood in San Francisco is immune right now from seeing homeless individuals on our commercial corridors, on our streets. And we want to make sure that we're able to address every corner of the city of San Francisco.
And then we'll visit a car club that teaches women what's under the hood.
As well as what it's like to actually be in a shop and getting really messy and stuff. It's real life, you know? It's great.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. San Francisco is in an ongoing battle to fight homelessness. One way the city measures how it's doing is with a homeless census conducted every other year. The most recent was in January of 2013, when the city counted around 6,400 people living in San Francisco's streets and shelters. And more than half of those have multiple health conditions like hepatitis, HIV, substance abuse, serious mental illness, or physical disabilities. Health problems are compounded by life on the streets. Being homeless means people die at a much earlier age than the general population. KALW's Laura Flynn met up with a group who come together every year to remember and honor those who have died on the streets.
Oh, we are beginning, my son.
About 100 people have gathered in a circle at Civic Center Plaza, a park at the footsteps of San Francisco City Hall. Holding lit candles, the crowd huddles closely together.
Good evening and welcome, everyone, on this rather somber occasion.
Reverend Lyle Beckman of San Francisco Night Ministry starts with the prayer.
May this be an opportunity to help to find ways to bring people into a safer place and care much better for those who are our sisters and brothers.
State Senator Mark Leno follows him with the Kaddish, a Jewish prayer of mourning.
Mikadal v'kadash shvei rabah, v'alma divra kirute v'amik malchute.
Prayers from other religions are also shared. Then Carmen Barsity of the Faithful Fools Street Ministry walks up to the microphone with a sheet of paper in her hand.
John Smith, 47.
These are homeless individuals who have died in the past year.
Paul Krasendowski, 38, gunshot wound.
This annual ritual began in 1990, a year when 16 people died of hypothermia on the streets of San Francisco. Reverend Glenda Hope, who ministered to the Tenderloin's poor and homeless, started it as a way to memorialize those who would otherwise be forgotten. Back then, Hope, with a small group, would pause at each location where someone reportedly died. Now, a much bigger group of friends, family, activists, faith leaders, and service providers gather each year in front of City Hall to remember.
I lost two friends in recovery. Both of their names were mentioned.
With City Hall lit up behind her, Greta Harper shares what brought her out tonight.
Michelle Smith, I thought she had a chance to live, and her liver failed her. And she was my roommate. Donna Williams was also one of my recovery sisters that died, and somebody beat her up, and she had to have brain surgery, and she didn't make it.
James Fry. Deborah Wilson.
Barsity reads off about 26 names in total. Some are John and Jane Doe's. She then turns it over to the crowd.
Passed away who have not been named, if you'd like to call out their names.
Joanne Ocean.
Johnny. Adrian Hernandez. Adeline Torres.
Some come to the mic with lists, including Jean Porfido from the Tom Waddell Health Center, a homeless service provider.
As far as I know, this one is just for our clinic, and it's the biggest one I've ever seen. There's four pages on here, so it's been a pretty sad year or so.
Porfido says he's trying to figure out exactly how many people have died this year.
There's probably quite a few more. We're trying to coordinate with the Knight Ministries and find out exactly how many lists there are.
But it's not that easy, at least to find an official count. The San Francisco Department of Public Health and Medical Examiner's Office each track homeless deaths, but they do it differently. The most recent numbers from Public Health registered 108 deaths in 2012. Numbers from the Medical Examiner's Office were not available.
Well, yeah, it gets pretty rough out there.
That's Matthew Coleman. He's been homeless and experienced firsthand the conditions that can sometimes lead to fatal outcomes.
Sleeping on the cold, on concrete, not having any clean clothes. You know, I was hungry. I was, you know, it got pretty brutal, pretty graphic, a little too graphic at times. You know, violence like you wouldn't believe. People overdosing around you left and right.
In the city's last homeless death report, more than 90% of those who died were younger than 64 years old. More than half of those deaths were drug poisoning and alcohol use related. Coleman says his own drug use cycled him in and out of jail.
Like when I was incarcerated, I was, you know, a moment hit me in time where I was sitting there thinking, wow, due to the bridges that I've burned, you know, nobody would, you know, Lord forbid, if anything happened to me right now, nobody would know about it. Nobody. And thinking, wow, I can't be the only one in the world that has that feeling or has that happen to.
If you are close to someone with a song sheet, we have a song called Oh For a World, which I would invite you all to sing. Oh for a world where everyone respects each other's ways.
Reverend Lyle Beckman, the leader of tonight's service, says San Francisco is a beautiful city, but it's hard for some.
And so many folks ignore people who are forced to live on the streets, or folks with mental health issues, or folks with other physical health issues in such a way that they pretend they're not even there. And we know better. So this is an opportunity for us to remember them, to honor them, to pray for them, and to lift them up to the one who created them.
At the end of the service, the lists of names are placed in an ornate metal pot where a fire burns. Reverend Beckman says he hopes people walk away tonight moved to create a healthy and civil city for all of its residents.
We welcome one world family.
In San Francisco, I'm Laura Flynn for Cross Currents.
That opens us to unity and gives our vision voice.
To hear more ongoing coverage of homelessness in the Bay Area, visit klw.org and click on Cross Currents. That's also where you can tell us what we should be covering. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. San Francisco spends about $165 million each year on homeless services. That's according to a report requested by City Supervisor Mark Farrell. In an attempt to understand the cost-effectiveness of those programs, Supervisor Farrell organized a series of 8 hearings this spring focused on homeless services in San Francisco. Farrell sat down with KALW's Ben Trefney to talk about what came out of those hearings.
What do you think has worked in the last 10 years? So San Francisco has, you know, depending on how you see it, done a good job, not such a good job of retaining a similar homeless level to what it had 10 years ago. What do you think is working well?
Number one, what we've actually done is we've started to implement some rapid rehousing programs. So people that are on the brink of homelessness here in San Francisco, rapid rehousing where we can provide rental subsidies on a short-term basis to make sure they don't end up on our streets. That's stemming the tide. We actually have really used a program called Project Homeward Bound, where if we can find family members or loved ones in the cities where these individuals are from that are willing to take them into their home and commit to that, then we actually provide a bus ticket home and meal money home. That is a very effective way for us to make sure that people not only don't become homeless and remain homeless on our streets of San Francisco, but also if you think about it, the care and love of their families in an infrastructure where there is a lot of support, that's where they have the best chance to succeed, not in a city where they don't know anyone or know a lot more limited people.
If they have family like that who is supportive, I mean, some people would say that that's just shipping the problem out to another city.
No, and we need to be very careful that to distinguish between the two. It's not as if the Nevada issue when they were dumping patients
exactly.
inside of our city of San Francisco. It is completely different than that. It's a very hefty screening process up front. We make sure we contact and we get a hold of and speak multiple times with their family or loved ones in different cities. And we track them to great success. I believe it was after a year, about 60% of those individuals are still living with their family members. 20% are living with other ones within the cities that we sent them back to. And again, it's putting them in this situation, whether it be inside of San Francisco or outside of our city, that they are in the best position to succeed. And that's what we want for them.
Are there other aspects of our 10-year plan that are working effectively?
Well, the number one recommendation, and it's one thing we have succeeded in doing, was building 3,000 new supportive housing units. And believe it or not, 10-year plans from government a lot of times don't go the way you might think they want to go. But we've actually succeeded in that. We're about, I believe, in the next year or two to build our 3,000th unit.
I'm interested in where the supportive housing units that are being built are. I know that there's so much development happening in San Francisco, and there's a lot of discussion about who is it for. So where are these 3,000 units being built, and what do they look like?
They're throughout our city, and there is no one-size-fits-all. To be honest, as a city, we need to be a little bit reactive and opportunistic in what we can build and what we can use as city resources. So when you talk about developers building market rate housing, we have an inclusionary housing ordinance fee where they have to pay a certain percent of the building costs to our mayor's office of housing, and then we can use that to build supportive housing units, or they can build those units themselves on site.
So we talked about some of the things that are working okay on the last 10-year plan that San Francisco established to reduce chronic homelessness. What have you found, then, that is not working well?
We have a number of services across our city and for homelessness, but what we also don't have, for instance, is a central coordinated assessment model. We don't have the ability or a centralized database, one might imagine, put a name into a computer and say, here's what we have in terms of housing available. We can put you into a shelter tonight, into a supportive housing unit. A little bit of a triage model saying, what are your needs? Is it just economic? Are there mental health issues? Are there other issues? Do you have family members involved? It is completely haphazard right now. We're trying to do a lot better with scarce resources in that regard, but we don't have that coordinated assessment model. So that has really failed over the past 10 years. The good news is we have worked on that for the past 2 years, and starting this fall, we're implementing a coordinated assessment model so we can make sure that if I come off of the street or try to come off of the street, we know right away what's available, where we can put that person. And that just speaks to making sure we use what we have in terms of city resources efficiently.
Were there any things that you've found in studying the 10-year plan that you think just really are not working at all and need to be scrapped?
I wouldn't say anything that needs to be scrapped. There's really nothing that we do that is a bad idea. It's really about being efficient and how do we think we need to address the problem. I'll give you one area, however, that I focused on early on. We have over 4,000 people sleeping on our streets on any given night. We have a homeless outreach team that is meant to be on the streets, engaging with these individuals, seeing if they would accept services. We only funded our homeless outreach team so that at any given point in time, 2 to 4 people were on the streets of San Francisco at any given time.
For those 4,000 people.
For those 4,000 people. That is ridiculous. 2 to 4 people on the street at any given time for a population of 4,000, nobody thinks that makes sense. So one of the first things I did was introduce legislation, and it passed, to double our homeless outreach team. It's still not enough, but it's a step in the right direction, and we want to have a more concerted effort. It's not only in our targeted areas such as the Tenderloin where people, I think, understand that there are concentrations of homeless individuals, but also in our neighborhoods. You know, no neighborhood in San Francisco is immune right now from seeing homeless individuals on our commercial corridors, on our streets, and we want to make sure that we're able to address every corner of the city of San Francisco.
When you have the HOT team, the homeless outreach team, going out to see if they can help out with the homeless people who are on the streets, is there enough housing or are there enough beds for these 4,000 people who are on the streets of San Francisco at any given time?
So part of what we did in that legislation was also allocate additional resources to have more housing opportunities for them. You know, as you think about housing...
So right now they're not, you're saying?
Today they're not, but now that the resources are there, we have the financial ability to rent these rooms. And there are two types of models. There's really city-owned or nonprofit-owned housing. That is really long-term based, right? We can have permanent affordable housing. Then there's also temporary housing. We call it the master lease program, where we actually are paying rent as a city for stabilization rooms and so forth. That's something that we can implement tomorrow, if you will. Now, the cost of rental housing is increasing in the city, even SRO rooms in the Tenderloin, which has been the prototypical type of stabilization room. But those are two different types of housing. One is really the long-term solution. I think everyone would agree that if we had the ability and we could build housing incredibly quickly in the city of San Francisco, that's the best solution because that's a permanent solution. But we have the balance between the long-term and the immediate near-term needs. And so, you know, being able to rent different rooms, if you will, for individuals on our streets to house them, that's something we need to do as a city as well.
What do you think about how the city is handling homelessness? Do you have ideas about how to best help homeless people? You can let us know by calling 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to feature your idea on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. A few weeks ago, the New York Times fired its executive editor, Jill Abramson, who had been the first woman ever to hold the post. That event fueled some heated discussion over gender discrimination in the workplace, especially in traditionally male-dominated industries. In addition to journalism, women are underrepresented in fields like science, construction, and the auto industry. Making a career in one of these areas can be an uphill battle, but at Skyline College in San Bruno, women who want to get down and dirty with cars are banding together to support each other. KALW's Jen Sheehan has that story.
Natasha Cronin is into cars.
We can see what kind of suspension we've got that we're on the car.
Cronin is a first-year student in the Automotive Technology Department at Skyline College in San Bruno. She and her classmates stand under the raised body of a dilapidated red pickup. Their task for today? Learning how this truck works by dismantling it, piece by rusty piece.
Take off the clamps again.
Cronin got into cars in high school, which wasn't that long ago. She's 18. She had a lot of car enthusiast friends.
I'd be, you know, on the sidewalk with them, or they're in the garage, you know, just doing something on their car, and I'd just be hanging out, and it was just like, oh, wow, you know, that's really cool.
When she graduated, working with cars was the only thing she could see herself doing. And though she already knows how to change her own oil and install a stereo system, she's learning much more in this class.
What it's like to actually be in a shop, what it's like to actually use the tools, what it's like to actually see the parts, you know, not just pictures and diagrams, you know, and getting really messy and stuff. It's real life, you know? It's great.
As her classmates look on, Cronin attempts to loosen a large rusted nut on the underside of the truck. She puts all her force behind a long-armed wrench, but the nut just won't budge. Cronin's professor, Julia Johnson, walks over with an electric tool called an impact gun.
Natasha?
Yes?
That'll take you several days. Use this. There you go.
Now using a power tool.
Yes, and this is going to shoot rust everywhere. So keep your mouths closed while she does this.
This scene unfolds so naturally, it's easy to forget that both of these women are anomalies. Everyone else in the shop today is male, and that reflects real life. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, women make up less than 2% of all auto technicians and mechanics, and hold just under a quarter of all jobs in the auto industry as a whole. Professor Julia Johnson knows this well. She holds a tenure-track position teaching auto tech at Skyline, but she started here as a student, just like Cronin. Back then, in 2004, there were very few women students in the department.
I was the only one to graduate in 10 years. There was one before me, 10 years before me, and 10 years before her was another one.
But she stuck it out.
I didn't know anything. I, you know, rounded off bolts and broke things and put my shocks on upside down, but I found out it's not that hard.
Our whole program is built around a family atmosphere. And regardless of man or woman, we're going to treat everybody the same.
That's Rick Escalambre, head of the auto tech department. He's been at Skyline for 30 years.
A lot of the old industry is still older males. I think there's also a thing that this is a grunt job where you're doing a lot of heavy-duty work. Today, so much of it is with the mind and understanding technology.
Escalambre saw that Johnson had both the mind and the drive for auto tech. So after she graduated in 2007, he hired her to teach. She wanted to make some changes.
The obvious lack of women was obvious.
So she got some funding from the school and started actively recruiting women for the department.
Came up with my own flyers, came up with my own message, and started hitting the high schools. And CalWORKS meetings, mothers' clubs, you know, pretty much anybody that would listen and a few people that wouldn't listen. And I just told them, you are welcome here. We want you here. You're not just welcome here. I want you to come to school here. The shop owners will hire you. This is a career you can do.
Her efforts paid off. 3 women enrolled that first semester, then 9 the next.
Then I wanted to keep them here because my experience was they usually leave after a semester or two. So I got them all together in a room, gave them pizza, and I said, let's form a club.
And that's how the Heart Wrenchers Auto Club started in 2010.
They took off like a rocket, and they used this club to do all kinds of amazing things. Primarily, they wanted to use their automotive knowledge to help other people. They're women, go figure.
The club members do free car repairs for people with low incomes and teach Girl Scouts and other youth basic auto maintenance. But the club is more than a way to do community service. It's a vital support system for its members.
Oh, amazing. Let me take a picture.
Okay.
Every Tuesday, the Heart Wrenchers meet in a small classroom off the Advanced Engine Lab. Today, they're planning a trip to a classic car show and fundraising for their free car repair clinic.
So I need to know how many girls we have, how many cars we can take.
Jelena Aquilina is the current president of the Heart Wrenchers. She says fixing cars runs in her family.
It was always my passion. Always. My dad was a mechanic. I grew up in the garage with my dad, and I could have come right into the program with no prerequisites because I was taking auto shop in high school.
When she got out of high school, she wanted to study auto tech, but
there weren't women here. There wasn't a club. There wasn't a support group for women in a male-dominated trade. I was intimidated, and I didn't do it.
So she worked at a series of office jobs, then had a child. But fixing cars was always in the back of her mind. In 2012, she decided to go back to school. It was time to pursue her dream. She's now in her final year of the certificate program at Skyline and is already working in the field at a shop in Mountain View. She's happy with where she works now, but she's definitely experienced sexism in previous jobs.
I would wrench them under the table. I could do 3 cars and they'd do 1 and they hated it. And so they took me off of a rack and they put me on cleaning duty. And it happened just all the time.
Talking about her experience with the other Heart Wrenchers helped her make the decision to leave that job. She says it was important to be with people who understood the challenges of being a woman in a male-dominated field. Now, Aquilina says her goals are evolving.
I wanted to be a mechanic. I wanted to be a tech. I wanted to wrench. And then I started tutoring. And I realized I'm pretty good at teaching this stuff.
Just like her mentor, Julia Johnson.
You watch the socket and make sure it's going counterclockwise. Yes?
Johnson's model of recruitment and mentorship is slowly spreading to automotive departments at other schools as she gives workshops and talks around the country. And she says that at least in the Bay Area, many auto shops are eager to welcome the women who graduate from Skyline.
I had a friend who 20 years ago couldn't get anyone to hire her. Nobody would take her on. And now I've got more opportunities than I have female students in the shops.
Students like Natasha Cronin.
Right, Ty, left, Lucy.
This way, okay.
Because I really want to turn this into a career. I really am passionate about what I'm doing here, so I'm trying to see where it'll take me.
With the help of Johnson and the Heart Wrenchers, that could be very far indeed.
You got it. There you go.
For Cross Currents, I'm Jen Chien.
You can find more information about the Heart Wrenchers Club by visiting KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Jeremy Dalmas, Audrey Dilling, Sandia Dirks, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ryan Miller, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Julia Scott, Melanie Young, and Eric Wayne. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our line producer is Leela Day. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Sheehan. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported local public radio. Once upon a time, probably before you were born, live musicians provided music as the audience watched motion pictures. The Marin Symphony plans to revive this tradition on Sunday. That's when they'll play the entire score of Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, as the film is shown. This Marin Symphony Pops concert takes place at the Marin Veterans Memorial Auditorium in San Rafael starting at 3 p.m. Eye patches are optional. All of that information, along with more local music and more local stories, is at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.